You are listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. I'm Rebecca Zimmerman. With early voting just a few weeks away, our show today will focus on important issues regarding the election. During the second half of our show, we will be joined by guests from the League of Women Voters and Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families to discuss voting basics and the Arkansas Advocates Voters Guide. But we will begin today with a discussion of ballot initiative issue one and the negative impact it could have on kids, families, and older adults in Arkansas. We are joined by Jesse Gibson, president of the Arkansas Trial Lawyers Association. Jesse, thank you for joining us today. Do you want to start by introducing yourself?
Sure. Thank you very much for having me. As you said, my name is Jesse Gibson. I'm with the president of the Arkansas Trial Lawyers Association. I've been practicing law in Little Rock for almost 20 years now. Kind of that pains me a little bit to say, but very true. I'm also I also serve on the Arkansas Bar Association House of Delegates, and I am the chairman of the Little Rock Parks Commission. So my plate stays pretty full.
Okay, well, my first question is, what is Issue 1?
Sure. Issue 1 is a referred constitutional amendment. Every legislative session, the legislature gets up to three amendments to refer to the people for a vote. One usually in the House, one usually in the Senate, and the third one kind of goes either way depending on whose turn it is. And one of the ones that came out of the 2017 legislative session is Issue 1, which is the so-called Tort Reform Amendment. It will basically do four things. First of all, it will place a cap on contingency fee cases. A contingency fee case being a case where a lawyer may take a case and front the costs in return for a percentage of any recovery he or she may or may not get on the case. It will limit those to 33 1/3% of the net recovery without really defining what the net recovery really means and leaving that to the legislature in upcoming sessions. The second thing it will do will be to place an arbitrary cap on compensatory non-economic damages, such as pain and suffering or even loss of life. Regardless of any fault, regardless of any action, how egregious of the act, it will place an arbitrary one-size-fits-all government-mandated cap of $500,000 on any life. The third thing it will do would place an arbitrary government-mandated cap on the amount of punitive damages that can be awarded of three-time compensatories or $500,000. Punitive damages are damages that are exceedingly rare in Arkansas, and they're usually to punish intentional conduct. Let's say if you have a red light, green light wreck out here in front of the studio, that's a negligent act and not an intentional act. And for the vast lion's share of cases, punitive damages are not available to you because it's not an intentional act. They're exceedingly rare and usually on business cases. But it will place a government mandated cap on those damages. The fourth thing it will do, and this is something that is quite surprising and shocking and very rare in states that have enacted any kind of tort reform, it would shift the rulemaking authority from the judiciary. Since Amendment 80, the court and the court alone has been setting its rulemaking authority, how cases progress in court, rules of evidence, civil procedure, even criminal procedure. What this would do would be to shift that from the court system to the legislative branch. And obviously that could open a Pandora's box of problems. Every time we pick up our paper, we see bribery scandals, kickbacks, corruption. Obviously for people in the legal community that believe in fair dealing and an open forum, it's very troubling. So those are the four things that Issue 1 will do.
And you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we're talking about Issue 1. If you have any questions, you can give us a call at 501-433-0088. So you mentioned four different things using a lot of complicated words. So can you go back to the first two, dealing with caps, and explain those kind of more using examples, what that would look like?
Sure. The first thing, which is the attorney's fees cap, what this would do would be to say for any contingency fee case, the attorney would be capped at only being able to collect 33 1/3% of the net recovery. Now, what a lot of people don't understand is that cases, especially complicated cases like a medical malpractice case or a nursing home case or a trucking case, require a huge outlay of capital, even to bring that case to court. It's not uncommon for a medical negligence case or a nursing home case for the attorney to loan the client up to $100,000 to front fee costs or court costs in the case for an expert witness, for depositions.
So that's what contingency fee means. The right. attorneys cover those costs themselves up
right.
front.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is that a lot of folks who may not have gone through litigation may not understand is those costs that the attorneys front in a contingency fee case, if you lose, you don't get that back. And in complicated cases like medical negligence cases where the defendants win, on average, nationwide 93% of the time, there's a lot of losses that occur. So what this would do would be to limit the amount the attorney can charge to one-third of the net recovery after repayment of, say, subrogation costs for medical insurance companies or anything like that. The intention is here, I believe, to make a lot of cases less attractive, where attorneys would have to look at a case with those high capital costs and say, I can't take that risk based on this. That's the first thing. That's what the attorney's fees cap, I believe, is meant to do.
So what would that end up looking like if that passed for the average everyday person who did feel like they were they needed to mm-hmm. file a suit for negligence?
I think it's a real access to justice issue. The intention behind this, what you're going to hear from the television ads, is more money in the client's pocket and take it away from the trial attorneys. It doesn't really go any deeper than that. And to explain what I'm trying to is about the risks involved and about how clients don't have to repay the costs if they do lose. And I've had many cases where I've not been successful and I've had to eat those costs. The end result, I think, and I believe the intention behind this is to try to entice voters and to try to show voters, hey, you're going to get something out of this amendment. Even though these last three parts may not be that popular, we're going to try to bring you in and lure you in and kind of bait and switch you and say, oh, look how you'll be receiving more money by this provision. So don't look at all these other things down here that you may not like.
But it sounds like what you're saying is an attorney might not even take their
Correct.
Case at all.
If you can't make it work financially for yourself or the client, you're going to have to just say no oftentimes. And I have to do that sometimes even now. But it would be much, much worse if this is passed. And that's the thing. The thing about contingency fee cases and contingency fees in general is they provide the poor man's keys to the courthouse. They couldn't pay, like, say, a Walmart or a Tyson or a big company can pay a herd of lawyers $500 an hour. They don't have the ability to do that. So it would really cut down on ordinary working people's access to the courts if something horrible does in fact happen.
So what, I mean, how much would people have to put up front? I mean, possibly if this happened.
Well, I think what would happen more than anything would be the cases just wouldn't be brought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most folks, you know, in Arkansas, the vast majority of people couldn't afford to pay an attorney an hourly rate for more than an afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally understandable. I don't even think it's a decision that people would be able to make and, oh, I'll pay hourly. They just wouldn't be able to pursue that case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really why this is in there.
And the second mm-hmm. cap you mentioned?
Sure. This is why issue one has been called the Price on Life Amendment, because what it will do will be place an arbitrary government mandated cap dollar value on things like pain and suffering or even loss of life. Now, to many people in Arkansas, like you mentioned earlier, children or the disabled or stay at home moms
mm-hmm.
that don't have an earning capacity, lost wages, lost income, economic damages are not available to them.
Mm-hmm.
So by capping non-economic damage, the pain, the suffering, the loss of life, what this amendment would do would be to say certain lives are just more valuable than others. The CEO is more valuable than a child. His worth is just more. The powerful executive would be worth more than a stay-at-home mom or a disabled person in a nursing home. And I just believe that's immoral. I think all life is priceless, and that by doing this, what you'll do is to say, we don't think this group, this subset of people is as important as these folks who might make a lot of money.
And again, you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas, and we're talking about issue one that will be on the ballot starting October 22nd with early voting. If you have any questions, you can give us a call at 501-433-0088. Just to clarify what you're saying, so if I'm just a regular stay-at-home mom and I get hit by a big fancy truck and die, I would only be able to get $500,000, but if I was a fancy executive, I'd be able to get a lot more.
Correct. And the reason is that there's economic damages, which are medical bills, lost wages, the things that you can put dollars and cents on. And then there's non-economic damages, pain, suffering, even the value of a life itself. Under Arkansas law, unless you have an earning history, right, a track record, basically tax returns the amount of money that you earn, any damages for lost income is speculative. So for a stay-at-home mom, for a disabled person in a nursing home, a child, those economic damages are not available to them because they're speculative. So what it would do, as you mentioned, is that for those folks, and so they can't get those damages, they're just capped at $500,000 under issue one.
Mm-hmm. So it also sounds like it, I mean, you'll have to bring, if you're the average everyday person, you'll also have to bring a lot of paperwork regarding yourself or your family member.
Yeah, that's true. That's the kind of the case now. I think really the issue is of disparate treatment, of disparate treatment between the haves and the have-nots. The folks out there who do have value. You know, parents, mothers, and fathers that stay at home, they have great value to people's lives around them, enriching those lives. And this would just say we don't put any value on that. And I think it would devalue the things that we are supposed to hold dear and the folks that we're supposed to be watching out for the most.
So I guess that does lead me to the question, because you're talking about different treatment for people with different incomes. I guess if the argument is to cap this so we won't be taking, greedy trial lawyers won't be taking a bunch of money, then why aren't the other types of financial damages capped?
That's a good question. You'd have to ask the proponents. So I think the folks that are financing this amendment would be just fine with that arrangement. And something else that I think that is very troubling about who the winners would be and who the losers would be under this amendment. It's quite clear to me, and you can look at the folks who would win, that the proponents of this amendment are insurance companies, big business in Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce, Trucking Association, Poultry Federation. Big business who stands to gain on their bottom line if they're able to limit what they can pay out when they do wrong. It's basically a form of immunity. Who would the losers be? The people, the citizens, the folks who do nothing wrong, the folks who are just victims of someone else's negligence. That's why I think our coalition and our campaign, and I'm with Protect Our Families, the Legislative Question Committee fighting against issue one, we've been able to reach groups on both the left and the right. Issue one is opposed by groups that might otherwise be seen as complete opposite ends of the political spectrum. It has opposition from AFL-CIO, labor unions, and the Family Council, from the Sierra Club and Conduit for Action, groups like the AEA, and also Secure Arkansas, and groups in the Right to Life community, but also groups that would be in the traditional left, like the Arkansas Trial Lawyers Association, the Arkansas Bar Association, the groups I just mentioned. So you have a wide group of people from the left and the right who meet in the middle to form a pretty solid coalition.
And again, if you have a question about issue one, you can give us a call at 433-0088. And you talked about changing the rulemaking process. Also, can you explain that a bit more?
This should really concern every listener because it could affect everyone's life, whether in a criminal case, civil case, domestic relations case. Since Amendment 80 to our Constitution, that the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court alone has made the rules of court, rules of evidence, rules of civil procedure, rules of criminal procedure, which dictate how cases go through court, what kind of evidence you can bring up, what the standards are. And the court goes through great measures to be open and objective, and input from both sides and debate, public comment, hearings. The legislature is just the opposite, where backroom deals abound, where if you ever think things are done in the open, the legislature is not the place for you. Shifting that rulemaking authority from the courts, where they try to be open and to try to get the best rule they can, and putting that in the legislature, where lobbying occurs, backroom deals, what we've seen in the last couple months, multiple instances of corruption, kickbacks. You can see that if a wealthy corporate interest wants to change or influence the rules, now it's hard to do because, well, it's impossible to do because the courts are in charge of it. Whereas if they are able to send their herd of lobbyists to the legislature to change rules to benefit them, they would do it. So I think it creates a situation ripe for abuse. And the folks that are caught in the middle that can't afford lobbyists to affect change would have to be at the whim of these lobbyists to change rules the way they saw fit.
So you kind of hinted at this. So you mentioned some not ethical things that have been happening in the Capitol that have been in the news for a while. So you're saying for those people who have participated in those unethical behaviors at the Capitol, they could change the rules so the trial goes in their favor?
It very well. I mean, as lawyers, we catch a lot of flack. We take a lot of public criticism. But the courthouse gives us a mechanism to say no to power, right? It gives us a toolbox or a toolkit to say, no insurance company, you're not going to deny this claim. No trucking company, we're not going to let you get away with driving an unsafe tractor trailer on the road. The legislature does not have, in my experience of 15 years of working out there, have the ability to say no when corporations and lobbyists want something. And I'm actually somewhat empathetic to them. The power that the lobbyists and special interests wield at our legislature is massive. So what we have is a situation, and some of the main backers of Issue 1, I'm going to make a couple of instances to make my point. Some of the main financial backers of Issue 1, when a jury in Faulkner County returned a $5 million verdict in a horrific nursing home case, decided instead of abiding by that jury's wishes, bribed the judge to reduce that verdict. That judge is now in federal prison. When a previous tort reform attempt vote was coming up, a senator who's now also under indictment received a wire transfer of $80,000. Well, you have groups that I think that are funding this, I don't think, that are very easily discovered to be funding tort reform in Arkansas, have shown their willingness to bribe and to make payments. And what you have is a legislature that has shown that they may be open to that behavior. We see kickback schemes. We see it almost on a daily basis, legislators taking kickbacks and bribes. I think you have a fertile ground for abuse.
Mm-hmm. And there was one other issue that you said was involved in Issue 1.
Right, the punitive damages aspect. We kind of blew right by that. And again, it's very rare. Punitive damages, like I said, is to punish bad behavior. And it's just a really uncommon thing. Because most cases that are general tort cases that the people deal with, it's a negligent act. And punitive damages are only for intentional behavior. But this would be to put a cap on what punitive damages could be awarded. There'd be no incentive for a company to act properly, and there'd be no disincentive for intentional tortious behavior. So that's what the punitive caps would do. And again, it's usually on a business on business thing. The big question I always have when discussing tort reform with people is why. In Arkansas, in 2017, only 9% of all cases involved tort cases, injury cases. By contrast, 60% were breach of contract cases. And we're going to be told on TV that there's a litigation explosion in Arkansas, and there's frivolous lawsuits, and there's runaway juries. The median jury verdict in Arkansas in 2017 was $3,757. That's all. Not a runaway jury. We're going to hear a lot about frivolous lawsuits. Nothing in issue one, the word frivolous, non-meritorious, or any synonym is nowhere to be found. It will only hurt a meritorious lawsuit with someone horribly hurt.
And a few questions with the minutes we have left. Has this happened in other states? I know there's multiple provisions mm-hmm. in issue one. Mm-hmm. Have these issues already been implemented in other states, and how has that played out?
There's no real rhyme or reason. Different states have done different things. Some states have done nothing at all. That's one of the things that the proponents have said. Well, a lot of our surrounding states have implemented tort reform, but it's funny. One of the things that we always hear, that the reason we need tort reform is to reduce our medical malpractice rates. But of all the states that are contiguous to Arkansas that have instituted tort reform, they all have higher medical malpractice insurance premiums than Arkansas. We have the 10th lowest in the nation. I think looking at what other states have done is illustrative of what we can expect. Because what we're going to hear is, if you can just give us tort reform, then there'll be a chicken in every pot, a doctor in every corner, there'll be jobs everywhere. But there will be human costs. I ask everyone to look at a study done by Texas AARP. After they instituted tort reform in 2001, the quality of their nursing care, serving the veterans, disabled, elderly, became the worst in the nation. There's no enforcement mechanism. There's no incentive to do right. That's what we can expect in Arkansas if tort reform passes.
And if you have a question about issue one, you can give us a call at 433-0088. So there's also, a court case about Correct. Issue one right now. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There is a legal challenge pending in the Arkansas Supreme Court. It was filed in Pulaski County in front of Circuit Judge Mackie Pierce, who I have great respect for and have tried many cases in front of. And the charges were, the claims were, that issue one is an attempt to log roll multiple provisions that are unrelated under the auspice of one amendment. And after a trial, Judge Pierce found that was in fact what they'd done, is that they had four different provisions, and then a fifth one really that I did not mention earlier because it's kind of some inside baseball, but it would lower the standard or the threshold for changing the court rules from 2/3 to 3/5. So what it's done is you have different provisions that log roll one another, and he found that was unconstitutional.
Okay, we have a caller. Okay, you're on the air. What's your question? I think you accidentally got cut off. If you can give us a call back.
And so what he found is he found that provision lowering the voting threshold is legislative in nature, and the four other ones that we talked about earlier are clearly judicial in nature, and that those were clearly not reasonably germane to one another. And then in addition to that, those four provisions we mentioned earlier are also not reasonably germane to one another. And so that's on appeal to the Arkansas Supreme Court. The final reply brief, I believe, is due tomorrow, and a decision could come from the Supreme Court anytime after that.
Okay, well, we might get a call back. And can you give us just a wrap-up about Sure. issue one?
Sure. I think that what issue one, a recent Talk Business Hendricks poll showed that only 25% of Arkansans supported issue one. 47% opposed it, with a large undecided block. But I think the citizens of Arkansas are seeing what issue one is, and that it's an overreach by a legislature that is run amok, desiring more power. I think what issue one is more than just tort reform. It's a battle for the soul of an independent judiciary. When this was moving through the Senate state agencies, it was pointed out that this may be violative of the separation of powers. And the response from the senators was, we know. And that's what they wanted. They want the judiciary to be almost an agency of the legislature that helps them further their policy agenda when it suits them, instead of a check on their on their actions, at finding some of their actions unconstitutional. And even they mentioned in some of the hearing that it went back to the court chipping away at the Civil Justice Reform Act of 2003, which was the first attempt at tort reform in Arkansas. The legislature doesn't like being told no, that their bills are unconstitutional, so they're seeking to change the Constitution.
How many attorneys are in the General Assembly?
You know, I really don't know off the top of my head. I can think of about half a dozen, but I don't. It's not near as many as it used to be.
Okay, well, Jesse, thank you so much for being on the show today. We were talking about issue one. If people want to find more about this and read more about this, Where can they go?
Sure. First, I'd like to, you know, they always say ask for the vote. I'd ask for everyone for a no vote on issue one on November 6th. But you can go to www.protectourfamilies. That's protectarfamilies.org. Or www.arkansaslibertydefense.com. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, always have a lot of new content coming out. Obviously, we're on the airwaves. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. You can always go on these websites, get more information about, there's a lot of meetups and events in your area. I make the round across the state quite a bit, as do others. I'd love to have you at any one of those events, and you can contact us through those websites. We'd be glad to get you any information we can.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Jesse. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.
KABF and Speak Up Arkansas would like to thank our underwriters, Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families, the Arkansas Education Association, Arkansas Children's, and the Arkansas Coalition for Peace and Justice, all supporting KABF, the voice of the people.
You are back listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. We've just been joined by Carol Young with the League of Women Voters and Marquita Little, who in a bit will talk about Arkansas Advocates Voters Guide. Do you both want to start really quickly by introducing yourselves?
Sure. I am Carol Young. I'm the convener of the League of Women Voters of Pulaski County.
Hi, I'm Marquita Little. I'm the Health Policy Director at Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families.
Okay, great. Well, Carol, let's get started with you. I wanted to bring you here today just to talk about some basics for elections so people are ready for the big day. So what day is election this year, and when does early voting start?
Election day is Tuesday, November the 6th. The polls will be open from 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Early voting starts Tuesday, October the 22nd. The hours are 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturdays. Early voting will end on the Monday before the election, that's November the 5th, at 5 p.m. We don't know the locations yet. The Election Commission is setting those tomorrow. I'm sure there'll be lots of publication about that when they set those sites. For the primary, there were 8 sites around the county, and including the County Regional Center at 501 West Markham, which is where MetroPlan and the Election Commission is. It's right across Markham from City Hall. I'm sure that will be an early voting site for this election. But there will be others in libraries and community centers around the county.
And where can people go to find out if they have registered to vote? They're not quite sure.
First, I have to put a little plug in for the League. We are going to have a one-stop shop, if you will. It's a website called vote411.org. It is not live yet. We are sending out candidate questionnaires. But when it is live, you'll be able to put your name and address in there. If you are a registered voter, the elections that you can vote in, the candidates you can vote for, will pop up. It's almost like getting a sample ballot of just your candidates for your specific location. But to find out if you are registered, if you have a doubt, if you are in Pulaski County, votepulaski.net is an excellent website. You can call the county clerk's office, and that number is 501-340-8336. They also have email, V as in Victor, R as in Robert, C as in Cat, R as in Roberts. That's VRCR@PulaskiClerk.com. If you're listening and you happen to be outside of Pulaski County, contact the county clerk in your county or the Secretary of State's office, and their website is sos.arkansas.gov. And then if you're not registered, there are plenty of places you can go to register to vote. You can download an application from the Secretary of State's website or the Pulaski County Clerk's website, fill it out, and mail it back in to either the County Clerk's office or the Secretary of State. Also, libraries, the DMV, and other state offices have registration forms. I just learned the other day that all the military recruitment stations always have forms available. Many school guidance offices will keep some forms available, so you could pick one up if you dropped your child off at school. And I just think it's important to mention that all of the application forms to register to vote are available in English and Spanish.
And when's the deadline to register to vote if you want to participate in this election?
October the 9th is the last day they'll accept voter registrations at the county clerk's office.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so people need to do that pretty quickly if you haven't registered to vote. The deadline's October 9th, which I think's a Monday, so you might want to have it in the mail by Friday if you do plan on registering to vote and you haven't.
And you can always hand deliver it to the county clerk's office if you want to make sure it gets there.
And you said there'll be sample ballots on 411.org. Do you know when that will be live?
I hope to have it live by the 15th.
By the 15th. So on the around October 15th, you can go on the League of Women Voters website, 411.org.
Vote411.org.
Vote411.org. And see a sample ballot so you'll know exactly what to expect on Election Day. So my next question is, you talked about the places where people might go to early vote, but how do people find out where they go to vote on Election Day? It seems like there's a ton of sites around communities.
There are. I try to make it as convenient as possible for everyone. If you have your voter card, which would be a little white card that you would have been mailed from the county clerk's office when you registered, it will have your precinct information on there and your normal place of voting in a general election. If you've been a registered voter for a long time, that voting place may have changed. The newspapers are really good about publishing that, and it will be on the Election Commission website. It won't be hard to find your correct precinct once they get set up a little closer to the election time.
So after people have gone on vote411.org and seen what's going to be on their ballot, how can they go and learn more about the ballot initiatives and the candidates that are going to be on their ballot?
The beauty of Vote411 is that we send questions out to the candidates, and they can respond by a closed email system so that none of their answers can be changed or tampered with in any way. So not only will you see the name of the candidate, but you will also see their answers to the questions, and you can compare candidates that way. The issues, such as tort reform, what was just discussed, and the other four that may or may not be on the ballot, considering four out of the five are in the court system right now, is the University of Arkansas Cooperative Extension Service. They do such a beautiful job on the issues that I wouldn't attempt to try to improve upon that. So that's uaex.edu. And when you get there, across the top on the banner, there's a section called Business and Communities. And under Business and Communities is Voter Education. And that is where you'll find some pro and con statements on all the proposed ballot issues.
Okay, great. And for some people, they want to go vote on election day. It's important to them, but they might have some issues with transportation. Do you know of any resources that people can access to make sure that they're able to, you know, use their right to vote and get to their polling place?
Rock Region Metro, the bus lines, do give free rides on election day. So that's one way to get to the polls. I did check with taxi companies. They are not providing free rides to the polls. I believe many churches in the past will use their church buses and go pick up people. One thing I highly recommend is if you drive, invite your neighbors to go with you. That saves gas, and in case you do have a little bit of a wait in line when you get there, you'll have your neighbors to visit with while you wait. I do wish there was a coordinated ride service for voting. I think it's a good program that the League should look at and try to coordinate with local churches and maybe local agencies that are already providing this so that we have a list of who is available and maybe be able to dispatch people from a central location or something. But that's something we would have to work with down the line. It's not in place right now.
But Rock Region, they do have free buses the day November 6th.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. And are there any other resources or anything else you think people need to know before they go to vote?
I've been getting some questions about absentee voting and how you go about that. And that is handled through the county clerk's office again. You can also download an application for a voting absentee. You can mail or fax that application back, or you can hand deliver it to the county clerk's office. You must complete that form and have it turned in by October 30th if you're mailing it. If you hand deliver it, you have to get it there by 5 p.m. on November the 5th, the Monday, the day before the election. And then you receive an absentee ballot. It must be received not later than 7:30 on election day. That's the time that the polls close. So all absentee ballots have to be into the county clerk's office by the close of election. And the other important item that I can't stress enough, unfortunately, because the League is definitely against this, but you must have a photo ID to be able to vote. So please don't forget to take a photo ID. You can have IDs made at the county clerk's office if you don't have a driver's license or any other type of ID. If you go to the polls without your ID, you will have to cast a provisional ballot. And after that, the only way you can have your ballot counted would be to provide your photo ID at the county clerk's office by noon the Monday following the election. So that would be Monday, November the 12th. You would have to show up in person at the county clerk's office and show them your ID, and then your ballot would be counted. So I would just like to encourage everybody, don't take that chance. Be sure you have your ID with you so that you can vote a regular ballot and have your vote counted on election day.
So one last time, when does early voting start? When's the election day?
Election day is November the 6th. Early voting starts on October the 22nd and goes through November 5th. And there is some early voting on Saturdays, not on Sundays.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Carol.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you sharing all those dates and important information. It sounds like definitely bring your ID if you can. And if you need transportation, thankfully you can utilize Rock Region Metro for free that day. So, Marquita, I want to move on to you and talk about the Arkansas Advocates 2018 Voters Guide. What is the Voters Guide? What's its purpose?
So I specifically work on health policy issues at Arkansas Advocates, and so we'll use that kind of as an example to tell you what you can find in the voter guide. It's a really short, simple go-to document if you want to know kind of what some of the key issues are as we're kind of going, as we're approaching this election season, and you want to know what are the things that you should be asking candidates, or what are the things you want to research before you go to vote. So, for example, on healthcare, We outline a quick update on if you want to know more or where a candidate stands on health care. We outline three quick things. Where we are today on coverage for children. Today, 96% of children in Arkansas are covered, mostly due to Our Kids First, which is Medicaid and CHIP funding. We also talk about Arkansas Works, which is the state's Medicaid expansion program for low-income adults. Again, we're leading the nation there in reducing coverage rates for uninsured adults. And then we just talk more broadly about access to health care and whether there, you know, where there are policy opportunities to improve or impede and make it more difficult to have access to care. So we have these really short descriptions of those key areas so that folks who pick up the guide feel like they're armed with some information on why that issue is important. Then we outline some simple questions. So again, for healthcare, couple questions you could ask a candidate is, how will you protect healthcare for children? So knowing where we are and the progress we've made, that's probably an important issue. How are we going to ensure children still have coverage? Another question is, what is your position on providing affordable coverage for adults who are low-income earners? And then we ask about other things like restrictions, putting restrictions on the Medicaid program, like freezing enrollment, as well as how we'll ensure that all children and families in Arkansas have access to high quality health care. And so, again, it arms you with some information, but it also gives you some very specific but broad questions that you could ask any candidate. All of the information there, you know, it's not based on any type of partisan platform. It's just based on the issues that matter to people every day. So that's kind of an example of what you would see in that section. And so we do the same thing on several other issue areas, early childhood education, after school and summer programs, tax and budget issues, family economic security, race equity, child welfare, and juvenile justice. So you'll find a bit of information, and then you'll find a little bit of information as well on questions you can actually ask a candidate. Also, if you want your policy information and questions in one place with dates and all of that other information, there's a little bit of information in there that's a quick rundown of all of those dates you just heard about, early voting dates, when general election is, hours that you can vote. That information is in there, as well as some handy tips on how to talk with legislators.
And where can people get a copy of the voter's guide?
So you can get that electronically on Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families website. That's aradvocates.org. We also have hard copies, and so I'm sure that if you reached out to us, we could make sure we get some hard copies of that guide to everyone as well. But again, it's definitely available online, so I'd encourage you to go and download it and take a look.
Great. Well, thank you, Marky. I really appreciate it. Yeah, go to aradvocates.org if you want a copy of that voter's guide and look over some important issues that are impacting kids and to find out where candidates stand on those issues. But Marquita, why we have you here, moving away from the election, I know that you've been asked about this by many people all over the world about this issue, but something really big that's happening that's all over the news and continues to be every month is the issue of the new work requirements for people who are part of the Medicaid expansion. So I wanted to talk with you about that today because it sounds like a lot of people still aren't aware of the requirements and still aren't reporting.
Sure. So I think this is probably maybe my third show where we talked about this. And so, unfortunately, it's a continual issue. And so in the earlier conversations where we were talking about the work requirement, we were really pushing and advocating for people to speak out, express any concerns they have about it in hopes that we would prevent our state from moving forward with it. And then since that time, because it was approved and the state started working towards implementing it, we've been actively engaging with a number of our partners in outreach and education to make sure people are aware. So Arkansas is the first state in the nation to implement what I think is more accurately referred to as a work reporting requirement. And so in the entire history of the Medicaid program, states have never been able to attach eligibility for coverage to any type of work reporting requirement. So we were the third state to receive federal approval to put this in place, but the very first state kind of ended up in a rush there to implement it. So in June, the state began to roll out this new requirement where everyone who is enrolled in the state's Medicaid expansion program, which is also known as Arkansas Works, all of those people at some point, because it's being phased in, will have to comply. So one of the first issues that comes up in terms of people knowing about this new requirement is that they don't actually know the type of coverage, if the type of coverage they have is impacted by it. So if you're in the traditional Medicaid program, if you are a child, if you are in Medicaid because you're a pregnant woman, you have a disability, or you're a senior, you are probably not going to be impacted by this work requirement. This only applies to those low-income earners who are adults who are in our state's version of the Medicaid expansion program, which is also known as Arkansas Works. So if you have maybe Ambetter, Blue Cross Blue Shield QualChoice, and you have zero premium, or you have a flat $13 premium, you are one of the folks who should be listening and concerned about the work reporting requirement.
And if you have a question for Marquita about the new work reporting requirements, you can give us a call at 433-0088.
And so that's the first step is you know, looking at your coverage and making sure that you are or are not one of the folks who has to comply with this new requirement. If you get a letter in the mail from the state of Arkansas, please make sure you read it in detail. And all of those letters will also, even if you don't understand the content of the notices, because they're a little complicated to understand, I'll be honest, there's going to be a phone number that you can call on your notice that will send you to some type of Medicaid helpline. And then you can call and also find out there. But this requirement essentially requires everyone who is enrolled in the program to take some type of action every single month, depending on what their particular status or situation is, to indicate that they are participating in at least 80 hours per month of work or work-related activities. So you're either working 80 hours per month, you're volunteering, you're doing some kind of work training. There's this really long list of exemptions. So if you meet an exemption, that means that you don't have to participate or demonstrate you're meeting that 80-hour requirement. So some examples of exemptions are people who have a dependent child in their home. Those folks are exempt. People who are in school full-time, those people are exempt. If you have a medical issue, a short-term medical issue, you would be exempt. But here's where it gets tricky. Some of those exemptions are automatic and some aren't. So you have to know a lot and understand the ins and outs of this policy. So for example, if you have a dependent child in the home, that's supposed to be an automatic exemption where the state can look at other records and information they have, make that determination that there's a child in your home. And so you're automatically exempt and you don't have to do anything. Well, if you are enrolled in college and you say I'm exempt from meeting the work requirement because I'm in college, you do have to log on to an online portal and report that you are enrolled in college, and you'd have to come back every 6 months to do that. If you say I'm exempt because I have a temporary medical issue, then you have to go into the portal and you have to recertify that every 2 months. So it's really important, again, to read the material, any material you receive, and to try to connect with someone who can help you and answer your questions, because it really is a complex policy. Unfortunately, Arkansas's policy also removes people from coverage who don't meet the requirement for 3 months. And so really you get three strikes and then you're locked out of and dropped from coverage. And that's three times during the course of that year that you can either not meet the requirement or three times that you just, you forget or you don't know how, or you somehow don't log onto the system and comply. After three times, you drop from coverage and you cannot re-enroll for the remainder of that calendar year. So this is why it is so important. Even though I would certainly say from an advocate's perspective, it's not the best policy. It's the law right now in our state. It's where we are. And so we want to do everything we can to prevent people from losing coverage. We saw at the end of August that about 4,400 people have already lost coverage. We're approaching that next deadline where we will probably see about the same number, if not a little bit more. In terms of people who will lose coverage. The numbers are not looking good. Great majority of people are still unaware or are not logging on to this portal. Number of people said they don't know how, or they just didn't know about the policy. Unfortunately, that's not a reason necessarily that the state will accept, and those that is counting against people who in many cases, I mean, they are in critical need of coverage, and they actually, in fact, need their health coverage in order to remain healthy enough to work.
So is the only outreach being done to raise awareness about this the letter that people are getting in the mail, or?
Mm-hmm. So the state has done a couple of things to do some outreach. So they have sent letters out to folks. One of the issues that's common, though, with those types of notices, and this is not unique to this to the work requirement, is that people often don't have updated addresses, or the state doesn't have an address for them, and so people don't really get the letters. So they're sending out letters. If you get it, you have to understand it. The letters aren't necessarily the easiest thing to understand. And they are making phone calls to people. Again, same issue, though. Is it the most current number and trying to reach out to people in that way? And then, you know, you can see some things online. If you're online on Facebook, Twitter, those places, there's some information. We have also conducted outreach. We've been doing social media outreach. We've been putting flyers together. A lot of our partner agencies are doing the same thing and have been. A lot of healthcare provider agencies are doing the same thing and just trying to make people aware of the work required. Unfortunately, it was so quick in terms of when the state received approval, just a few months until they actually implemented it. So despite all of those outreach efforts, there just has not been enough time to appropriately prepare people for this work requirement. One other important thing I'll mention is that a lawsuit has been filed in the state. Kentucky, we saw Kentucky a similar lawsuit prior to Arkansas's, and their work requirement was struck down. So they never moved forward with implementing it. They are kind of rewriting the policy, and their state is still trying to move forward with this new version of the policy. There's a pending lawsuit that's been filed on behalf of some Arkansans who are impacted by it. We don't know what the outcome of that will be. You know, so in the meantime, it's still important for people to move forward with trying to make sure they are in compliance and doing everything they can to keep their coverage.
So is the state trying to find new ways possibly to increase outreach and awareness about this, since so many people are obviously not hearing about it?
Well, I'll tell you one way that the word is getting out is because of the really all the press coverage around the coverage losses. And so it's been in the national news media and local news media quite a bit. So I think just by it's unfortunate that the media attention, you know, is, I mean, it's unfortunate the that people are losing coverage, but I do think that more people are at least knowledgeable and asking questions about this now, because it has been such a huge issue in the media recently. The state also, you know, I hate to get complicated, but I think this is really important. The state also has an exemption called a good cause exemption for people who have some kind of emergency situation, life event, internet access issue, and you miss the reporting requirement for that month. Again, it's very specific, though. You know, you have to have had like a death in the family or something like that that would have prevented you from reporting that month. People can contact the state and request a good cause exemption, and it may or may not be approved. I think the last report I saw, so the first month, nobody requested it and used it. They've been trying to increase information and knowledge about it. The second month, like 5 people used it. And then the most recent numbers I saw, about 55 people requested the good cause exemption. And so it's still a small number of people, but that's just a little bit of recourse that folks might have if they have an emergency situation that prevents them from being able to meet that reporting deadline. They may go back and erase a strike, but it's not a standard list of things that say if you do this, you qualify for good cause. So it's really a case by case basis. The state has said that.
So it's at their discretion.
Yes. So you just have to get that request to them, and then at the state's discretion, they may waive that person not reporting that month.
And that makes me think also. So, do we have a call? Nope, they hung up. if you do have a call, though, you can give us a call at 433-0088 if you have a question. So to clarify, if someone is working like they're supposed to every month and they just forgot or didn't know they were supposed to or didn't have access to a computer or whatever for 3 months, even if they are doing what they're supposed to, there's no way they can go back retroactively and say, wait, I was working during that time and keep their coverage.
So I would say it's worth a try. You know, I would encourage that. So, I mean, it's a couple options you have. You could definitely try and request that good cause exemption. So the other thing, the other resource, Legal Aid of Arkansas, they have always offered assistance to people in that kind of situation. If they feel like they've been removed from coverage inappropriately, Legal Aid can help people request an appeal. And they can help to have them go through the process of appealing that decision. And maybe, you know, somewhere along the lines, there might be a decision to reverse that kind of decision. But those are basically the avenues that, you know, I would suggest is maybe certainly if it's an internet access issue or something like that or an emergency, they can request that exemption. But they also have the right to appeal that decision. And Legal Aid of Arkansas is one of the organizations that can help people kind of understand what their rights are there.
Mm-hmm. And kind of similarly, if someone should qualify for an automatic exemption and they're for whatever reason kicked off, even though they shouldn't be, what should people do? Contact Legal Aid?
Well, yes, definitely. They can contact them to help them navigate that scenario. And they should reach out to their local county, DHS county office, directly about that kind of thing. We see a lot that people, sometimes not even related to the work requirement. That's kind of an administrative error. And unfortunately that kind of thing also happens a lot and people end up losing coverage. And so, I would encourage them to contact their local county office if there's some kind of administrative error like that.
And if people are unfortunately kicked off their coverage, are there other healthcare options that you would recommend that they try to identify to further care in the meantime?
So, I mean, those options unfortunately are very limited. The state is supposed to, if someone is kicked off, they are supposed to be sending out letters that list other options for them. Throughout the state, we do have community health centers. And so you can try and locate a community health center in your community. They exist specifically for treating people who are under or uninsured. They usually offer services like on a sliding fee scale. So that's one of the few options. And unfortunately, a lot of people end up having to rely on emergency rooms. And that's not the best way in the way that we want people to be able to get access to their care.
Well, like we just talked about, make sure that if you are covered by Medicaid, if you get a letter in the mail from the state, make sure you read it carefully. Make sure you follow the instructions on there. And if you need help understanding, you can contact DHS County Office or Legal Aid of Arkansas and get more information about that. But make sure that you keep your coverage. That's all for today. We appreciate you listening to Speak Up Arkansas with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Families. And we'll be back next month. Thank you so much.